I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 12th Scanon podcast of 2018. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Jason.
Ronan.
And Emma from film.
And this week we are talking, we're going to jump in to talk about what we normally talk about first, which is what we watched this week. So Jay, what have you watched this week?
Well, Darren, I'll tell you what I watched this week.
Thank you, Jay.
What I really, really watched.
Will you tell me what you watched? What you really
I didn't
really
watch Spice World, although I do want to watch Spice World because people keep telling me it's great fun.
I think it's due a rehabilitation.
I would love to revisit Spice World because it's literally been 20 years of this.
Tune in next week when we discuss Spice World.
The Spice World special.
But I won't talk about it this week because, I haven't seen it. And I find that's a good qualification for talking
excellent.
About it. Although not necessarily.
No, definitive.
Boring. Yeah.
What do you think about Ready Player One, Jay?
Well, we'll skip past that. Song to song, Ronan. I watched Malick. Finally, I meant to get to this in my end of year rewatch kind of stuff, or watch to kind of confirm my list. Didn't, and finally got to it. And unsurprisingly, I was a big fan.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't seen this one.
Oh, have you not?
No.
I suspect you probably won't like it, though, because you weren't a fan of Knight of Cups, right?
I was extremely negative on Knight of Cups.
And I actually preferred Knight of Cups from RT to this, but I really like both.
So I'd hate it.
Yes.
it's like a bizarro thing, which you might like slightly less.
It takes a little bit of time to get going, and a little hard to connect it in that kind of, because the way that kind of editing kind of can distance you from characters and stuff, you see in Knight of Cups as well. But it does click, and Rooney Mara is very good. Gosling is Gosling. You know, he does stand around in rooms,
boring,
which he pretty much does in every film.
I thought you were
Oh, I'm so pretty.
I'm
not actively despising him at the moment.
Okay.
So I guess in technical
we're
terms...
We're still recovering from Lost River.
No, that's not the issue. It's Drive. I really don't like Drive.
Oh,
chill.
And then
room.
The silence.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's very rare you have a moment of silence after Jay's opinions.
I'm not a big fan of Gosling.
Yeah.
But strangely, I've loved most of the films he's been in.
Yeah.
So he doesn't put me off.
That's interesting.
Enough to put me off.
He almost loses his star
Drive
for most films.
Yeah.
Drive is my mother's Gosling movie of choice, which I don't want to read too much into.
That explains a lot about you, Darren.
Thank you.
Is there nothing you like him in?
In what?
Gosling, is there nothing you like
about him? He's pretty good in the Nice Guys, which a film I wasn't that gone on, but I liked him in it. I liked him in it. I didn't particularly like the film.
And there was the Big Short as well, I think.
Big Short, he was okay.
Yeah. I like that I basically got a little calendar of Jay's opinions of Ryan Gosling just to hand
Sad.
Here.
Maybe just like
we
the
see a peak
side.
Around 2015.
But he's okay in this. He's okay in Song to Song. I imagine it's very difficult starring a late Malick film because you don't really know what you're doing because there's no real script, and B, the editing and how the films are put together means that you probably don't know where you're filming certain sequences when you're filming them and what it's about to do with it. Like
that's been the case for 20 years now. Yeah, it's like you could show up thinking you're the star and be like,
but this
is,
I think,
one.
Just in the context of how
the Sean Penn effect.
But I think he's got little kind of narrative has gone completely out the window at this stage in that regard.
So
I imagine it gets even more difficult. I think he did okay.
I admire what he's doing in that regard. It just doesn't work for me at all.
That's exactly it, I think.
I kind of liked To the Wonder, but the aspects where it went towards that, I thought it's in danger of falling down somewhere here, and I thought Knight of Cups absolutely did that. I could not stand Knight of Cups.
I absolutely loved. They made my top 5 or 6 of the year. The thing, what's really interesting about it, and I think it speaks to a larger kind of thing about film and how people see their directors and how people see the kind of directors you like. What do you want from the director? Like, do you want them to be doing something different, or do you want comforting, familiar films?
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting thing because, like, people love the Malick of Badlands and the Malick of
Thin Red Line.
Yeah, which is a good comeback film. But there's even trace of a good Thin Red Line where you can elements
absolutely.
That.
Oh yeah, where you can see the bridge.
That style is starting to
emerge. But like even like it's 70s stuff, and people like it's like people go and see gigs and want to hear
the
greatest hits. You know, like what do we want from filmmakers? Like, I mean, I think there's something really admirable about Malick just kind of swinging for the kind of the biggest, most ambitious, weirdly make no sense films.
Yeah.
And he's doing something and trying to find something in edits and trying to find something in
And try aiming for profundity, whether he gets there or not, is arguable. Ronan would probably say he doesn't. But
well,
like,
no, but I take your point. I absolutely think agree that it's great to see him trying to find it.
And I like
it's good to see that
I think
people are getting something out.
Exactly. And I think something like, when you watch a Scorsese film, I'd be kind of personal fan in that regard, that do we want to see another gangster film or do we want to see something else? And it's a very interesting question.
The issue, though, because Scorsese works frequently enough at his age that he can do both.
Yeah.
You can get something as weird, and you know, let's be honest, maybe as unsatisfying as Silence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you'll get the comforting gangster film next.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think that's fair. I think we need that. Even if you don't like the film, I think it's important that filmmakers do something.
Push
themselves.
Because otherwise it's a little dull.
Well,
so
particularly in this era where we live, where you're constantly recycling old pleasures.
Well, that's exactly it. So, you know, I'm hats off to Malick. I know it's not for everyone, but I do like the fact that apparently he'll have a new film at Cannes, which is heavily scripted, and it's set in World War II.
Oh,
so, you know, let's get on that, people.
Should be interesting.
And the other one I mentioned before I finish up, Daughters of the Dust, which is really, really good. It's one of, I think Grace mentioned on the End of the Year podcast.
On the 250.
250 End of the Year podcast. 250 is a great podcast, by the way, and you should listen to it. I am not being paid for this advertisement.
Thank you, Jay.
But Daughters of the Dust is great. It's the story of the particular kind of group of people that lived on islands, it's off North Carolina, who were kind of descended from slaves, and then they kind of moved towards the kind of mainland at the start of the 20th century. So it's kind of a true-ish story. It's a narrative film, but it's kind of covering
inspired
that area.
By true
events. Exactly. And it's fascinating, beautifully shot, and it, without kind of reducing it to kind of descriptive styles, it's very Melickian in that sense. Like it's very, you know, it's kind of frees up. It plays with narrative and kind of linear, non-linear kind of structure. It's incredibly shot, and if you've seen Beyonce's Lemonade, you will have seen the kind of influential that it was. But the story's great, the cast are incredible, and it's like really, really beautiful. And like the director, who's Julie Dash, made it in the early 90s, and this would have been around the time of your Tarantinos and stuff would have exploded around this time with Reservoir Dogs. And it's staggering to think that like there's no real career. She's done TV stuff. She did Queen Sugar, the Ava DuVernay. She did episodes of that and various other things. But like, she didn't have the career that clearly this film marked out that she should have, where more than likely lesser talents have kind of prospered. And you know, is it because she's black and is it because she's a woman? Of course it is. But so recommend it. It's on Netflix as well. It's excellent.
And it's getting a real revival lately. I think
it
had a big screen re-release last year.
I think the Beyonce thing heavily visually referenced it, kind of brought it back into the kind of cultural conversation in that regard, and also the kind of, you know, the role of black filmmaking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that's great, and it's on Netflix, and you really should watch it.
Well, I have watched an awful lot lately. I have been off work.
Lightning round.
Guzzling films down. No, I won't spend too much time talking about too many things, and I'm going to be very off-brand and talk about positive things only for a nice change.
What?
I know. On the new on Netflix note, there is Gods on Country, which is my pick for the best film of last year.
Nice.
It was regularly sort of pitched as a Yorkshire Brokeback Mountain,
yes,
which I think does it a tremendous disservice
so
very many ways, because Brokeback Mountain is a particular thing. It's of its time, it's a good film, but it's, you know, in everything from the tragic aspects of the story to you know, the kind of the way that they put these things together, it's very much 2005 film. And I think God's Own Country is very much of its time. It shies away from these things. It refuses to be tragic. But rewatching it, I was just struck by how I cannot believe it's somebody's first feature. The direction in it is incredible. It's just put together beautifully. And it's so, like, the images do all the storytelling. There are three incredible sex scenes in it that, taken together, they just represent the change of this relationship. And it's really, really beautifully done. So that is on Netflix. And
I think it was number three or number four on my list last year. It's tremendously strong. Brilliantly active with two main guys.
Yeah.
They're really good. It dares to be hopeful. Which is
I know what you're
getting on. I think Brokeback Mountain is fine. I think it's an absolutely glorious film. But I take your point that it is that type of film, and this type of film.
Yeah, there's that whole symbolic thing of, you know, this sort of moral transgression must be punished.
Yeah,
that, even in 2005, was still very much the thing. It's still new for something like God's Own Country to be allowing people to have what, you know, you could argue the extent to which it's happy ending, whatever.
Is it that, or was it simply that, like, at that stage, they were pitching those narratives as much more sort of prestige pictures, and so you wanted a downbeat ending to sort of sell the seriousness of it?
I don't know. I suppose in terms of Brokeback Mountain, you look at the source material.
It was an adaptation as well.
Yeah. And I also think that Boys Don't Cry as well, around the same time, in terms of LGBT. So.
Yeah. Well, if you look at Brokeback Mountain, the source material, it's actually from a book of short stories, like, about American masculinity through the lens of the cowboy character. So that's, I know what you mean in terms of prestige pictures, but I think it's getting more to something of kind of upending traditional ideas of masculinity, which obviously Gods and Country does very much too, because you're talking about farmer characters and you're in an area of England where there's very much a focus on the ties to the land, this kind of thing. And there's, of course, there's a crippled father character, all sorts of things about
played by Ian Hart. And when you live long enough to see Ian Hart playing the father character, you realise you've been watching films a long time. Because I remember Ian Hart being young in films. It's like,
oh, yeah,
Lord.
Now, he was also the father figure in Boardwalk Empire as well, as I recall, in their Godfather 2 flashback season.
Ah, yes. He was in Michael Collins when he was quite young back in the day.
Yeah. I also caught up with a couple of new releases, the highlight of which was A Fantastic Woman, which is just
good, eh?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's terrific. Yeah. Daniela Vega's performance is incredible.
It's for the ages. She's fantastic. And the camera, stunning.
It's this, you know, it's just this classic woman who carries an entire film. And this real sort of untraditional narrative completely hinged on her performance and her reaction to the world around her. And indeed, very proactive a lot of the time. I really was stunned by it. And the elements of fantasy that sort of creep into
the moments are done.
There's an incredible
windswept
nightclub
as well.
That's in the trailer where it leans into the wind. Yeah. And sort of, you know, a very effective visualization of the characters gaining agency against a world that would sort of hold them back. The nightclub scene, which is just a real. Again, it's a film that visually communicates the idea of characters taking control of the world for themselves. I haven't seen Gloria, Lelio's previous film. I've heard it's very, very good. It similarly sort of looks at a female character who previously might not have got much screen time.
Oh, okay.
So he's actually got his first English language film coming out later this year.
I thought it was the Rachel Weisz that was supposed to be at the Film Festival. Was that that one?
Disobedience,
that's coming out here in a couple of months, I think.
That one that was pulled, was it?
That was pulled because it was premiered. Okay, well, it was pulled and then coincidentally premiered internationally.
Ah, okay.
I think in Tribeca, New York.
Okay.
I kind of think about Fantastic Woman, like, it's a weird one. I've been thinking about it since I've seen it. I saw it a couple of weeks ago. And I liked it. I adored the first half, that kind of, where she has like a death from a thousand microcuts, via words, and then look at her face every time, just take a hit, and they're all tiny, minute kind of things, but it's a build-up kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where I thought it kind of lost its way a little bit in the second half, but the more I kind of think about it, over the last couple of weeks I've been thinking about it, I think I was being a little harsh on it, and I kind of already want to watch it again to see if it works slightly better. And I don't know what my beef was exactly, I can't quite...
I think it's a film in a way that's in search of catharsis, but finds it in very subtle ways.
Yeah.
You know, there is one, I suppose towards the end there is a moment of sort of an outburst of anger that's more comic than anything else, but there is no great moment where everything pulls together because it sort of slowly does it, that you realise that, you know, victories are slow and subtle.
Yeah, it's probably fair.
Yeah, I really, really loved it. It's going to be there at the end of the year, my top 10, I reckon.
Nice.
And then the last thing I'll just quickly mention, I caught up on an Irish film, A Date for Mad Mary, which I hadn't managed to get in last year. A lot of people have told me that it's something I should check out, and I really liked it. Impressive stuff. Really, really good central performance.
Yeah.
And it's one of those performances that it's not necessarily a very likable character in traditional sense. She's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
The kind of character you could easily sort of brush aside and say, well, I'm not interested. But it's beautifully sold and comes together slowly, and just by the end I was really, really impressed.
There's a scene in it that still kind of, I think it's one of the best scenes in Irish film in the last few years that I really liked, and just for one particular reason that Irish films have a lot, and a lot of films in general do it, but like where I think a lot of times we, in Irish films, we kind of talk to what's happening as opposed to the visually represented.
Yeah.
And the scene, it's in the chipper where she's there and the girl comes in and realise who she is,
yeah.
and then leaves.
Yeah.
And you find out a whole heap of information from a silent kind of thing.
Yeah,
and nothing
absolutely.
Happens, like, except what you see. And it's like, and it's notable because a lot of our shows don't seem to have the confidence to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case.
There isn't
or not.
A character who comes along and goes, "What was that look?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then somebody explains it,
yeah.
what you've already seen.
Yeah.
And there is a confidence thing in filmmaking. And I remember watching it, I really like that. Somebody has realised that that's enough, and these actors are really selling the hell out of it. So I just really like that.
Yeah, it's equal confidence in the actors and the audience.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Really agree.
No, I loved it as well. And Shauna Kerslake, isn't it?
She's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really
but someone did say to me after, and I only realised it afterwards, why do they all have Dundalk accents? It's set in Dublin. But that's the only bad thing you can really... It's apparently set in Dublin.
It's filmed in Dundalk,
They all have Dundalk accents,
I think it's filmed in Dundalk.
Yeah. International distribution.
International.
Yeah, they
absolutely won't.
Nobody in Argentina knows where they're from.
Fortunately, I don't remember that scene. I wish I did. But,
no, it's just where I remember stuck to me when I saw
it.
And it kind of, when I rewatched it, it kind of was more apparently kind of that. It was nice. It was just nice to see.
So, Emma, what have you watched recently?
Haven't seen anything old in a while. I've been up to my eyes. But I got into my head last night, I wanted to see Journeyman.
Okay.
And I raced down to the IFI and missed it.
Oh no.
Raced up to Cineworld. Their machines were broken.
Oh.
It was just one of these.
This
it was meant to be.
Just not meant to be.
Got
the
a free ticket because their machines were broken.
Oh,
so
okay.
Anyway, that's the backstory.
Results.
It was just like, I want to see it tonight and that was it. But I mean, I loved his first film. Absolutely loved it. It's just kind of down my street, that kind of... depressing, gritty stuff is what I'm all about. But
luckily, Journeyman is a barrel of laughs.
Well, strangely enough, it actually is. I did like it. I would like to see it again. I just thought, Paddy Considine is just absolutely amazing. I didn't really know much about it when I went to see it. I don't know if anyone has.
Yeah,
read
it. It's a boxing
film. Yeah.
Well,
it has a lot of development. That's
I kind of have an idea already about what happens.
And the poster, which is great, the poster design's fantastic. The poster design kind of hints at where it's going.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, it's not really a spoiler to say he gets
an injury or something.
He gets brain damaged during a fight. Strangely enough, he wins the fight. He's going up to defend his championship. And he remains a champion, but unfortunately...
which I thought was a nice touch, actually.
Which is quite nice, because as you're watching it, you know it's going to happen later, so you think he's
going to
get
knocked out. We all know the boxing beats.
You expect he's going to defeat and then claw his way back,
exactly.
But it's like he wins.
But unfortunately he wins, and the damage happens just a little bit later. But I suppose the main thing going for it is his performance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's playing...
He's a fine actor, constantly.
He's a great actor.
Well, I love him. I love him in everything.
Yeah.
I love him in all Shea Meadows stuff and all that kind of stuff he's done. I suppose Transtor is kind of that same kind of style. But I suppose maybe the good thing about this film is that, you know, it might appeal more to the mainstream, I guess. You know, it's quite a feel-good movie by the end. It's quite sentimental, which I always veer away from. But, you know, the acting is really, really good. I did feel... Jodie Whittaker is his partner.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'm not used to seeing her on the big screen. I don't know if
she's
in a lot.
TV,
you know, she reminds me of she's the girl in Broadchurch or she, you know, she's in the... So I kind of sometimes felt I was watching a BBC, very good BBC drama. I didn't really feel...
A cinematic
aspect to it, despite the fact that it's really well directed and there's some really beautiful scenes, like some... really tear-jerking scenes. There's a scene where his wife gets quite upset with him. He puts the baby in the washing machine. He wets himself. You know, he's like a child at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so she just can't take any more, and she goes off. And there's a scene where she calls him, and he's asking her to come home. And it's just this lovely, perfect kind of combination of a child and an adult. You know,
yeah,
and he's begging her to come home.
Yeah.
And he has all the tics very good. He kind of, you know, but he doesn't overdo it, and it's not patronising the way he behaves. But yeah, his performance is just really excellent. But I would say it's a far cry from that kind of real kind of raw kind of gritty stuff.
It's more formulaic. I quite liked it. I think it's very well directed. I think it's very well made. Yeah. I actually thought Whittaker was very good as well. But it is very much it's beat, beat, beat.
Yes, yeah. And it lacks a lot of subtlety as well. Like you're saying about the Irish film, you know, there's lots of dialogue, I think, that could have been way more effective had it been removed and just left in this kind of silence. And,
there's a moment where himself and the other boxer have like a conversation about their deep psychological issues, you know, where the boxer's like, this is why I behaved the way I did earlier, and I'm sorry. And you're like, thank you for articulating your very clear character arc.
And particularly with men, I'm not saying men, but men.
It's all right, we're in agreement.
You know, the kind of, the boxing lads.
The machismo sort of,
Their kind of class as well. They're not the types really, like, to sit down and say, this is how...
This is how I was feeling inside myself when I said those mean things at the press conference.
Yeah, but I think if it gets him
listeners
some
can't
attention,
hear Ronan wincing.
I think it was a little sniffly received. I think London,
Constantine got quite upset.
Yeah,
about
he did, and he threatened to not bother making any more films
and stuff like that. Acting.
I think he kind of calmed down, and I think he's particularly sensitive. As a guy,
very sensitive.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop acting if you don't like what I direct.
That's it. Yeah. No more Considine for you. You don't have Considine to kick around anymore.
Sorry, James.
What do you do without Considine now, people? But I think he's a fine director and an actor. And he'd be sadly missed if he didn't make any more stuff. It doesn't necessarily mean... you know, we all have to praise the film to keep him happy. I will see it. When you said about the idea of like a kind of BBC thing, when it came out and it kind of slipped by me, and I was like, I'll catch it at home because it looked like the one that it's a nice Sunday afternoon watch.
It is a little bit. And to be honest, if I had read it, was just one of those films that it just popped onto my radar. I saw Paddy Considine, and I was like, oh, geez, I have to see that.
And plus, you put a lot of work into getting there, so
I have to see it. Like I said, if I'd read much about it before seeing it, I possibly would have waited. Yeah.
But it's nice when you kind of just go into the cinema without knowing anything.
Yeah,
really.
And
it's a rare thing, isn't it?
Travel, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. I absolutely want to see what else he is made of. You know, I'd like to see more of the Tyrannosaur side.
I mean, Tyrannosaur, Jesus, that killed
me. But it's not for everyone, you know?
Yeah. It was on TV recently. And
yeah, I think
I watched,
showed
it, I watched about 5 minutes of it, and I kind of had to just... you know, push it away and say, no, I'm not able
not
for
today.
This right now.
It's
a really tough film.
Yeah. It is a tough film.
Yeah. It was one of these intense scenes between Peter Mullen and Olivia Colman where I actually can't stomach this.
Yeah.
It has that kind of power.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree. Completely agree.
That's all for me anyway.
It was a good backstory, though. I
thought it was
the
most epic adventure I think any of us had to see.
It's just when he handed me the free ticket, I kind of rejoiced.
Yeah.
You know, when you get
something
for free.
Free ticket's amazing.
I caught up again on some stuff that I missed from last year, actually the year before, which was The Limehouse Golem, which is Juan Carlos Medina's film, written by Jane Goldman, actually, which is kind of what drew me to it. I'm actually quite fond of Goldman's writing. This is the... I know, Populist. Darren the Populist.
this one completely passed my eye. I barely know the name, but tell me a bit.
And possibly justifiably. I mean, it's a good film. It's grand. So it's The Limehouse Golem. It's based on a novel loosely inspired by the Jack the Ripper killings, in case the tagline, poster, and general aesthetic of the film did not convince you that that's what it was doing.
All right.
It is interesting. It's more interesting than it's good. You can tell it's an adaptation in that it's... very much a story that is suited to prose and doesn't really work on film. It's got a lot of pacing issues. It's got a lot of flashbacks. It's got a lot of exposition. It's got a lot of explaining stuff to the audience that you could translate very well in prose, but you can't convey effectively on screen in a period drama convincingly. However, it is also, in some ways, a quite kind of clever film. It's very much an interesting exploration about the horror genre and sort of like pulpy, trashy narratives and the way in which those have traditionally served to tell stories that you wouldn't normally see in sort of higher brow education.
Yeah.
So, for example, in this case, the plight of, say, the Victorian era sex workers who were being victimized and abused and stuff like that, where you would see that in the cartoons, the Penny Dreadfuls or the musicals, but you wouldn't see that portrayed as much, say, in high-profile plays. So it's an interesting study in that respect. It's got a really great performance from Olivia Cooke, who is now in Ready Player One, and also redeemed herself slightly from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, a movie.
What a CV.
Yeah, I know. A movie whose primary sin is not even the half-assed rhyme in the title. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible movie.
It is.
It's a movie about how hard it is to have a friend who's dying of cancer. And nobody
remember,
said no.
I still haven't seen it, but I remember there being such vitriol towards
it looked
people.
Like the quintessential Sundance film.
It was,
yeah,
and that's where it came from as well.
Of course
it
did.
It's very much, The Lime Has Gone is better. It's enjoyable. It's fun. It's clever.
If you say it's grand, Darren, it always worries me. Because grand for me is not necessarily grand for you, I don't think.
You're
a bit nicer than I am.
Which one of us has gone to see Ready Player One, Jay?
Oh, we think everybody knows that, Darren.
Cool. And then otherwise, I finally got around to watching Spielberg, the documentary from Susan Lacy, which you talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is not bad at all. Being honest, I kind of agree with you. When you talked about it a few weeks ago, you mentioned the fact that you would have liked if it had gone into a bit more depth and sort of the unseen aspect.
Yeah, the failures. I want more of that.
Yeah, Jay wallowing in human misery. No, it's a valid point.
We all know the successes. Yeah. Like, I want to see why didn't Hook work? Why didn't...
Yeah.
You know, I want to hear that.
Interesting.
Particularly with time and perspective.
Yeah, and particularly because failures tend to be more interesting than successes, just in general, because,
in terms of how they shape a career.
Happy families are all alike. Terrible films are all terrible in their own way.
Indeed.
But yeah, I would happily sit down for Ken Burns' 13-hour Spielberg documentary in which we go behind the scenes and in-depth focus on, you know, the behind the scenes of what the hell happened on Poltergeist.
Yeah.
That's not this. This is very light touch. It's very breezy. It is impressive, though, because it gives... First of all, it gives you a sense of just the sheer scale of Spielberg as like a monolithic sort of entity that towers over American cinema. It's also interesting in terms of obviously him sitting down and contributing to a discourse on his career.
Sure.
And I mean, you get some really great Spielberg lines where it seems like one of my favorite Spielberg moments is when he was talking, I think it was inside the Actors Studio or basically some equivalent of that, where he was talking about making Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and the host made the point that... it occurs to me that your father taught music and your mother was a scientist and they got divorced and separated. And in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you reconcile the two by making contact with aliens through the sound of music. And Spielberg's sitting there in the chair opposite him going, I never actually realized that. You could see the light bulb going off over Spielberg's head. And it's like one of the things I really like about Spielberg is you get a sense that the light bulb is like dimming upwards. And it's not insulting
to
the man.
I'd probably agree with that.
He's becoming more self-aware. There's a really great moment where he's talking about his filmography and like with a big smirk on his face, with the smirk of any blogger writing about Lincoln, he says, actually, Lincoln, now that you mention it, is kind of about a separation and a reunification. So you get sort of like Spielberg contextualizing films in terms of its own pop psychology.
Yeah, I agree. You don't quite get enough of it, but I agree. No. And what makes the documentary kind of work, insofar as it works, because it's too long as well.
No, it's not.
It's a bit too long. But Spielberg is very engaging. And he's interesting.
Almost
and
a great storyteller.
Film is not necessarily equal raconteur. You know what I mean? Right. It's not necessarily the case.
All right.
But anyway.
We may have words later.
Indeed.
If only there were a Spielberg film coming out on which we could have a heated debate at the end of this podcast.
Unfortunately, that is not the case.
Sadly.
But no, it's good. And it's a kind of oddly moving about his parents as well at the end. But the documentary... It feels like it misses an opportunity, that's all. It's almost there, but it's not quite there.
Again, I understand exactly what it is. And like the fact is, I watched it on a Sky Movies channel, which is astounding for a documentary about a filmmaker. To have it air on, not on TCM, not on Sky Arts, but to have it air on one of the Sky Blockbuster channels.
Spielberg probably demanded it. And he gets what he wants.
That's a bit unfair.
I'm joking.
But anyway, with that in mind, then we will segue neatly into talking about this week in film. Emma's actually joined us this week to talk about The New Music, which is an Irish film that's currently finished production on, I believe.
So it's an Irish zero-budget feature film, finished production just at the beginning of the year. So the stage they're at the moment is crowdfunding for their post-production, so editing, sound, that kind of stuff. So it's the film is made by an Italian film director called Chiara Viale, and basically it's about a young guy, young gifted pianist, who gets diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's disease. So at the moment, we're in the middle of Parkinson's Awareness Week. Next week is World Parkinson's Awareness Day. Nice. So I think it's a great idea for a film. Before I met Chiara, I didn't know young onset Parkinson's existed. Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty much an older person's disease.
That's kind of the standard.
So it's got that, you know. So along with the perception that we all have, I suppose, there's a stigma that goes along with it. Then if you're 25 and, you know, you start noticing these symptoms, it's, you know, it's quite difficult to deal with. So as a result of her father suffered from something quite similar to Parkinson's, and she wanted to deal with a character that was kind of stopped from doing what he really loved, you know, because of an illness. So she started reading up about Parkinson's. She got in touch with Parkinson's Ireland, and it went from there. So the film is crowdfunding at the moment for its post-production. And the script has been approved by the Young Parkinson's Ireland, and they've seen a rough cut of the film as well. So ideally, it's going to be ready for release to festivals at the end of this year.
Oh,
and so I know we've done an interview with Chiara on scanon.com, so if anyone wants to check it out there, give it a few quid, price a few pints, just to help them get through post-production. Yeah. That would be great. It's GoFundMe/the new music feature film.
No, it's really great to see that sort of level of Irish filmmaking, to see, like, the, you know, basically we're reaching the stage where you can have independent movies like that coming out.
Yeah, well, the film was made on zero budget. They're all up-and-coming actors involved in theatre. The main character is Cillian McAvoy, so he plays Adrian, who is the pianist. He's been in quite a lot of theatre shows. He's made his own film, The Clear Thin Air. And yet they're all kind of, you know, excellent actors that are up-and-coming in the Irish film scene.
Very good.
And I've seen the trailer, and it's pretty excellent quality. So.
The trailer's available online, is it? Or is it?
It is, yeah. The New Music, so Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So, yeah, check it out.
Perfect. And in other news this week, the East Asian Film Festival is currently taking place in the IFI. It's opening tonight with a screening of In the Mood for Love.
Just happening as we speak.
As we speak. Not as you listen, but as we speak. It's taking place all over the weekend. They actually have a very special guest in the form of the cinematographer, who is Mark Lee Ping Bing, who is who's worked with... I apologize for mangling the pronunciation here. I'm Hao Hsiao Hsan, and other sort of masters of sort of cinema. But it's running all weekend. They'll have a number of films from his career, including Springtime in a Small Town, Three Times. They'll have a documentary about him, Let the Wind Carry Me. His latest work, which is 77 Days, and he'll be running a masterclass on Saturday, which may be tomorrow when you listen to this, or maybe today when you listen to this.
that hurt my brain.
May indeed have been last week, if you're slow to listen, which we welcome you to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's good to know these things that are happening. But it's good. It's really nice.
It's a really nice festival lineup, and I see they've got two Hong Sang-soo films, which are apparently both great. I haven't seen either of them. Claire's Camera, and I've forgotten the second one already. But On the Beach at Night Alone. He knocks them out really quick, and they're always really good fun. Really interesting filmmaker in the way that his films are very often slight variations on each other. So taken together as a body
of work. Have we seen a film of his?
You may have. There are a couple over the last few years that have done good business. Isabelle Huppert was in one a few years ago. I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it now.
So you're as bad as me then.
Thank you. No, he's breaking through more and more in the last few years, and he puts out at least two films a year. But they're a lot of fun, and there's always a lot of people sitting around and slowly getting very drunk and just dialogue heavy. They're very fun.
Okay. This is in the films, not watching the film.
But that's all to my experience.
If you feel the urge. In other news, the Irish Film Board has extended the deadline for their POV funding applications through to April 20th due to unprecedented demand. They held an online Q&A, I think, last Friday, in which they sort of dealt with questions regarding the program, which is designed to encourage young female filmmakers to develop their ideas and their stories and bring them to screen. It's really great to see that.
It's a terrific idea. And
it is.
Obviously, the demand would suggest that we've been crying out for something similar for the last 10 years.
And the film board has seriously pushed for gender parity lately, and that's to be commended. And it's great to see that they're getting the talent coming forward to claim this. Long may it continue.
Yeah. It's open to live-action feature films that can be produced at the required budget level of 400 grand, 400,000 euro. Because when you say 400 grand, it doesn't sound quite as impressive. No limitation on genre, narrative, style, content, or other elements of the screenplay or story. So it's open
to anything.
To anything, basically. So you want to make a low-budget zombie apocalypse movie, you want to make a gritty urban drama, you want to make like an intimate character study, an absurdist sort of whatever, you can do it, you can pitch
just
through.
Just no documentaries.
We're separately funding this, that's fine. Very good.
Ronan speaking on behalf of the Irish Film Board there. Or in the person.
My dear friends and I at the board.
Yeah. But you can find the link online to apply at ScanOn, but you can also find the IFB website. So then, let us move on swiftly to the top 10 movies in Irish cinemas this week. And before we begin, Emma, we have a very important question to ask you as somebody who hasn't been on the podcast before. Have you seen The Greatest Showman?
No.
Oh, no.
The Greatest Showman, which has been in the top 10
for
since
5 years
apparently
now.
The dawn of time.
It's just so impressive, and it gets more impressive.
It really is.
I know, I really will have to check
none
it out.
None of us have seen it. Oh, no, no, wait.
That's why we asked you.
It gets more and more embarrassing. This is since December. Oh, yeah. I haven't get to it.
If I'd known, I would have.
I will say,
yes. Give a free ticket.
That's your prep right there.
Since my last appearance on this podcast and our discussion then about how we should really go see it because it's doing so well, I did try to see it, but it wasn't in the cinema I went to. So I don't know how it's in the top 10 if it's not in cinemas.
By the way, all three of us who are at Emma were in that conversation and agreed to see The Greatest Showman.
I tried.
I got fake news. I don't think I agreed to that. That doesn't sound like me. I wouldn't say that.
But that earned 27 grand last weekend, coming back into the top 10. It dropped out and it came back in. Ironically, we had a guest on last week who had actually seen it, but we couldn't talk about it because it wasn't in the top 10.
I would have brought it up anyway because it's the only chance you'll get.
At number 9, we have Roar Uthang's Tomb Raider, the reboot of the video game movie series.
That's a magnificent name.
It is.
It's a roar.
Yeah. It just screams I should be directing a Tomb Raider movie.
It does.
No, that's probably not fair. No, it's grand. It's a perfectly serviceable film, which is not the rigging endorsement
that
I suspect
they're
looking for.
Your praise.
My high praise. It's a video game movie for people who think the most exciting part of video games are cutscenes. Remember in the 80s...
I have never seen that based on this that description.
Yeah.
Remember in the 80s when, like, if you were making an action movie, you would open with a scene of the character doing something dramatic or action-y. Yeah. Like, if you're opening a Tomb Raider movie, what should your first scene be?
Somebody walking into the box, you can't figure out the controls. No, just me.
Awkwardly sidling.
Falling into the water all the time off under the ledges.
Jumping towards a square ledge and missing terribly.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. Sadly, no. It opens with Dominic West monologuing about the tomb that they will be raiding. No. And in case you missed that, there's a conversation halfway through that reiterates the same information.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I am not seeing this. You are not selling it.
That's that sounds like it's a movie that expects its audience not to bother showing up on time. Inbuilt
sort of
film. It's
like
20 minutes in.
Queuing up for nachos.
an inbuilt 3-minute buffer.
Sorry, the nachos people just don't go down well.
They have the leverage.
Big nachos are after you.
Number 8, A Wrinkle in Time. Ava DuVernay's blockbuster.
This is kind of done okay considering that nobody's expecting it to do anything after a certain point.
Considering its reputation, it's not earned back its budget.
No, I wouldn't imagine it
will. Probably not within its theatrical lifetime, which is a massive shame because it's actually not terrible. It's not great. It's got some very serious flaws in terms of pacing, structure, and in terms of like the act of adaptation. But it's also got Ava DuVernay directing. It's wonderfully visual. It's got this wonderful color running through it. It's got, you know, Chris Pine and the Hotline Bling video. Like, I mean, what more could you ask for?
Oh, well.
It's interesting. Like, I read an article about it during the day. There wasn't somebody saying nobody's going to see this because, you know, there's an issue with kind of black filmmakers or female filmmakers. It was more the kind of argument was that, like, fair enough that people are criticizing it and, like, you know, it does have flaws similar to what you're saying. But that they're saying that it's a film that's it's quite a huge amount of heart.
Yeah.
And that the point is, the writer of the article was making that critics find that a lot of critics seem to find issue
hard
with
to measure,
hard to measure or appreciate, maybe.
Well, that's fair.
No, I haven't seen it, so I would just agree with that
to a certain extent. Like, I mean, the most convincing argument that I've seen made and that I would make for A Wrinkle in Time is that it's a film that relies on a childlike sense of wonder.
Yeah, and that was mentioned in that regard as well.
It relies on you being willing to go with it. And it's undoubtedly, like, let's not beat around the bush here. It is undoubtedly related to racism that you've seen issues like this, the vote degrading of this on, say, Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb. This is a lower IMDb rating than Justice League. I sat through Justice League. This does not deserve a lower rating than Justice League.
I have not sat through Justice League, but I suspect I would not be a fan.
I never contemplated my own mortality while watching A Wrinkle in Time, which makes it an immediately superior film. It is, it's not a fantastic film. It's not the film of the year. It's quite enjoyable children's entertainment. It is much better than to pick on a filmmaker we're apparently picking on this week, than Hook. Yeah. But anyway, at number 7, Pacific Rim Uprising.
I probably kind of want to see this.
Really?
And I'll tell you why, two reasons. One, I quite like the first one, even though most people didn't.
Really? People liked the first one.
Yeah. Was it? No, I think
it's the best Transformers movie by a considerable distance.
And the second thing is, I do like things punching big things into buildings. That isn't Transformers.
Important qualification there,
it is
there,
because
Jay.
Of, the Bayhem and whatnot. Yeah. Like,
No, it is.
The world of Bayhem.
The best Godzilla movie made by a Western filmmaker and the best, Transformers movie made by any filmmaker.
This is such low bars.
What about the Transformers animation, goddammit? That's a good film.
Tell it, Ronan.
Orson Welles! You can hear the sound
Citizen
of him.
The Citizen Kane of Transformers
movies. Yeah. You can hear him cashing the check.
Oh, you can.
Just going to get me some fine wine.
number 6, still in the top 10, Ryan Coogler's Black Panther, which is on pace to overtake Titanic at the US box office this Friday.
Wow.
Which is remarkable.
How does that shape up with how it's doing worldwide? Is it similarly cracking Titanic?
This is interesting.
It's done well, I think.
It's done well. It's the only movie in the all-time top 10 to have made more than half its money in the States.
Which is interesting.
It's unusual these days, isn't it?
Particularly with the dependency on the China box.
There's a real interesting thing there about the sort of the different cultures, and it has been a runaway success in the US.
It absolutely has, which is interesting because that's where you suspect that a lot of the people who waited until 2018 to make a Black Panther movie were banking on it not doing particularly well.
Which is
just an astounding success story. Mm-hmm. It's looks like it'll still be in the top 10 when Infinity War comes out.
I went to see it. I didn't go to see it. I went to see The Greatest Showman, but they didn't have it, so I went to see Black Panther instead. which, isn't... I get the feeling they're not terribly similar. But I sort of had an interesting time with it. I really like Ryan Coogler. I'm a huge fan of Creed. I think it's a terrific film. I'm not crazy about Fruitvale Station, but I see a lot there to admire.
Yeah, that's pretty fair.
And I wasn't crazy about this. And I had an interesting time trying to reconcile what was going on. Why don't I like it? Is it to do with the hype? People saying it's crazy. People going crazy saying it's so great. And I kind of went up, I was like, I love Creed, and that's doing something similar, playing with a formula. Why don't I love this? And I think it's just because, ultimately, I don't like the Marvel superhero movies, where I love the Rocky movies. So I can totally understand, if these are things you like,
this is an incredible film to you.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, it's not that I don't like Black Panther. I think it's by far the best of those films, as far as I'm concerned. It's got so much going on behind the scenes, the ideas of race, of fatherhood.
Well, colonialism,
of
legacy, narrative.
Absolutely, and possibilities untapped. And what I really, really admire about it is a lot of the discourse I had read about it was talking about how, it looks at the possibilities if colonialism had never come along and robbed Africa of its potential. What is really interesting is that the central argument of it is sort of not... will we bring our story to the mainstream, but does the mainstream deserve our story? Does it deserve the richness of our culture? And that's really, really fascinating. And it's really grown me with time. I think Coogler has done something incredible in getting something to this many people. And to a certain extent, it has to be wrapped up in the annoying formula where at the end I didn't know who was hitting who because I couldn't
remember. They're all wearing the same
couldn't remember
CGI
who was
costume.
Orange and who was blue.
Purple, yes.
For Christ's sake. But... yeah, no, it is really impressive.
What bounces off of me, sticks onto you. But yeah, I can see what you're saying there. And I mean, that would be the issue. I would say that I'd go further and I'd say Creed is a better movie than Black Panther. And the reason that is because it isn't just that Coogler takes the Rocky formula. It's that he has the freedom to do things like shoot entirely handheld. Like the first boxing match in Creed is that wonderful long take, handheld, guerrilla-style footage. He would never have gotten away with that here. And he doesn't. And the film follows the stock beats. And I mean, I think he does it very well.
But he knows how important it is, even within that. For representational purposes, for smuggling things into a story that.
I know. I'm not saying you are.
I'm just kind of agreeing with you.
All right. This is an uncomfortable feeling.
It won't happen very often, though.
But no, and I understand the importance of that in terms, and it is very important in terms of showing that you can tell a story with a black lead character in the exact same way that you would with a white character, and still find a way to tell something that is unique and sort of, you know, something that's very personal, very moving. Like it's profoundly, like it's a movie that opens with father tell me a story about home, and a child growing up in Oakland daring to look up at the sky and wonder. Like it's a very personal film. He grew up in Oakland.
Yeah, I think it carries that stuff really well. Yeah. You know, it towards the end it does that same thing that The Last Jedi did, of sort of looking at the sky and seeing these things and
as a child,
having a sort of metatextual thing about the kids who are watching this film, they're going to be inspired this way, and I think it does it a lot better than Star Wars does, that you kind of walk out thinking, yes, they're...
What's actually built into it. The issue with the Star Wars thing is that it feels at the end like a coda. It feels like something just tacked on, as opposed to this being woven very cleverly into the fabric of it.
Yeah.
At number five, Duck Duck Goose.
Finally. He says on the film he's only heard of 20 minutes ago for the first time ever.
Weren't they holding that back for Cannes?
Le Canard Noir. This is from Christopher Jenkins, who directed Surf's Up, which...
Directed the hell out of it.
He directed the hell out of it. Thank you very much, Jay.
That's all right.
But which was famous among the anthropomorphic celebrity, sports-partaking animal films for its clever mockumentary style. I haven't seen Duck Duck Goose, so I can't confirm or deny whether Christopher Jenkins does something similarly innovative with the form with Duck Duck Goose.
Are we being serious here? I don't know what's going on anymore.
He likes to make films about birds.
Yeah, this is the recurring motif in his filmography. Duck Duck Goose, I think, is only actually officially releasing this week, so it was actually made this money off
preview.
Expect
to see it next week.
Oh, it's going to make a lot of money. Time for Easter.
Duck Duck Goose is coming at you.
Yeah. We don't need to egg it on, eh?
Yes,
oh, no. Quick. What's
next? Would you rather flip at the bird, eh?
Yes.
Oh, don't worry. I feel like this Christopher Jenkins is a bit of a quack, if you ask me. At number four, animation, but probably for adults, it's Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs.
Which I haven't got yet.
I haven't seen either. It's been a busy week. I'm hoping to see it.
Probably my favorite film of the year so far.
Whoa!
I know, and I like Three Billboards, guys.
I thought there was a moratorium on that.
I'm extremely excited for it as somebody who absolutely adores dogs and really love Fantastic Mr. Fox.
It is. It's a great love story about dogs. It's about a little boy who ventures the edge of the world to find his puppy. Come on, tell
Roland's
me.
Roland's already crying.
Yeah, I'm a little worried that it will instantly lose me just at the first sight of a dog, which, you know, then I worry that, you know, my critical faculty is just totally gone. They probably are, and that's fine. I'll be back next week to talk about how much I loved it.
Why is he holding that dog,
I am so in love with the sort of wave sweeping the world of dog-friendly screenings in cinemas.
Oh,
yeah.
The
Lighthouse is
I
doing a sixth one.
Anti.
Really? Oh. When they're special, not every screening, just these special ones.
Even though I don't have to go, I understand. I don't have to be there. I can't even see an advertisement for a dog-friendly screening, and it makes me angry. I don't like dogs. I don't really like Wes Anderson, so I guess that's not for me. So,
how do you feel about mother and child screenings?
Probably the same.
Mother and child and dog screenings?
That's it, you combine them all together.
I like dogs, right?
Yeah.
I don't like cinema.
I love
dogs. Necessarily...
you don't need them together.
I worry
see what
about,
I did there with the title.
You know, go
along
bathroom.
And sit on the same
They put a special blanket out so that there are no hairs or anything.
And they kind of moved a bit.
And they reserve the right to eject dogs that are not behaving.
Yeah, which I think is very important, and they should do more often with humans.
Yeah.
Right. And the role of newspaper as well.
Yeah.
Bad audience.
There was a film I saw not so long ago, and I can't remember what it was, but it had been quite emotional, and I was in the second row, and the lights came up, and sitting in a seat in front of me in the front row was a dog. And I was just like,
what? Sitting on the seat.
It looked at me. I looked at him. We looked into each other's souls.
Yeah. I'm one of these people who just has an instant emotional reaction to dogs. If you put, like, I love the Kevin Spacey movie Shrink because there's a dog in it. That's it.
Ronan, I'm learning a lot today. Yeah.
Kevin Spacey's in it now, and you know that changes things. Yeah. But no, the dog. You know, dog wins out.
Dog beats Kevin Spacey. How do you?
That's a rolled up newspaper, as it should be.
How do you feel about Nine Lives is the real question here.
I've got so many questions, but let's move on.
All right, then. At number three, another movie that's not technically opening until this week, it's Blockers, which is directed by Kate Cannon, starring Leslie Mann, Ike Barinholtz, and John Cena, about a bunch of parents who set out to stop their daughters from losing their virginity on prom night, and is much better than that description makes it sound.
Yeah, this has
got
good reviews.
I've heard it is much better than it looks.
Yeah, it's seen some good reviews.
Pretty painful.
It has a picture of a rooster and the word blockers underneath, in case you don't get what it's going for.
It's like they designed the promotional material exclusively to make me roll my eyes, and it worked wonders. A bus went by me with it the other day.
But it seems to be
quite good. I mean, one of the interesting things about it is obviously it's directed by Kate Cannon, who had input on the script. She worked with Tina Fey on, for example, 30 Rock, but she also worked on Girl Boss, the Netflix show that only lasted a season as well. She's talked about how she tried to smuggle in all this sort of like feminists, how she tried to make it kind of progressive and pro-sex as opposed to avoiding or sort of like puritanical and reactionary. Sure. And one of the interesting things about it is that much like, I think, say, Bad Neighbors 2, which is the Seth Rogen, Ivan Goldman film from a couple of years ago, it's interesting to wonder how much of this sort of like pro-sex, progressive, sort of feminist stuff is happening under the radar with these sort of gross-out, broad, crowd-pleasing comedies. Because, I mean, it's interesting, because you obviously point to like films like Moonlight in terms of, or Call Me By Your Name, in terms of like pushing diversification in cinema and diversity in cinema and like opening people's eyes and sort of like generating empathy and stuff like that. But films like Blockers and Bad Neighbors 2 are going to play much broader.
Yeah.
Mm. And people who are going to see them will hopefully grow up and maybe having watched a bad Seth Rogen movie at the age of 12, grown up with a better, healthier attitude.
My only issue with that kind of conversation, and you're probably right, probably is something that, but I wonder how much of that passes people by.
Versus how much of it gets absorbed passively. We talk about like toxic masculinity as something that's absorbed passively, right? What if you did the opposite? What if you created a culture that fed in even passively? Even in your comedy that includes...
God, what a nice world that would be.
Yeah, even in a comedy that includes, and I quote, butt-chugging,
Don't ask that question.
You want to know that?
I could probably guess.
We'll talk about it off podcast. Yeah, we'll talk about it off podcast. But
you know, you almost had me going to the cinema to see this.
Really?
And then you had to say that.
You mean butt-chugging isn't a selling point, alas. I actually really liked it. It's surprisingly sweet, surprisingly earnest. It's very well-intentioned. It is very broad. It's no Game Night, unfortunately, but few films are. At number two, a new release, Ready Player One. Steven Spielberg's film...
I am not ready.
Oh... it is actually probably the best video game movie in the top 10, although that is saying very little. It's grand.
There's that word again.
It's at its best when it's just a Spielberg film, where it's you know, got this sort of adventure about young idealistic kids who are fighting off these uncool, cynical adults. But then every once in a while it has to go back to the source material, which is awful and has aged really, really, really terribly. It's a movie which suggests that gamers taking ownership of gaming is a good thing that should be celebrated.
Oh, dear.
When,
that's dated.
As of about 2015, 2016, that's probably
that's the last thing we want.
I'd actually much rather have the corporate overlord played by Ben Mendelsohn, thank you very much. At least he sort of seems equal opportunity in his evil. It is a movie that is very confusing. It's unquestioning in its nostalgia, I think, and that's a Spielberg trend in general. Like, it's a movie that's all about the monetization of fandom, and it's how, like, corporate exploitation of fandom is evil. And then you're like, but dude, you bought all the games that you're a fan of.
Yeah.
Like the company already owns the intellectual property that you are idolizing.
To what extent? I've heard some people argue that Spielberg really knows what he's doing in bringing those ideas up in the context of his career. To what extent do you think he's doing that and sort of assessing his own career through this, pop culture legacy and the way art and commerce intersect?
David Edelstein in IndieWire did a really great article on this. And I'm perhaps not as charitable to Spielberg as Edelstein is, because he makes the argument that Spielberg is basically reconciling himself with the fact that he is responsible for this culture. That he's positioning himself as the Willy Wonka character in this Charlie and the Chocolate Factory nightmare. And I think there's a certain element of truth to that. I think he's very sympathetic to this idea of an old man who created a virtual world in which an entire generation have grown up and refused to let go of, and has basically perpetuated a culture of nostalgia in which nothing new can thrive and everything creative is suffocated. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at that and you're thinking, that's reasonably fair. But then the film doesn't have any teeth. The film, like,
you need to have to go for it.
Really have to go for it. And Spielberg, as much as, you know, like, remember that period where he did Munich, or that period where he did AI, or the period even when he did War of the Worlds, which were the most cynical movies that he's ever made. If he did Ready Player One in that style, I would be much more enthusiastic about it. The issue with this is that there's a sense of he is befuddled and he is deeply uncomfortable. He's talked about how he took out all the references to himself and his own work, which is understandable. Like, I can understand that. Wanting to basically, I didn't corner the market on the 80s, I think is his exact quote on it. And I can understand the, you know, lack of ego in that.
Yeah.
But I feel like the movie needs to have a bit more teeth if it's doing what it sets out to do. And I feel like a lot of it is just Spielberg proving he can do what he does as well or as better than many of his contemporaries. And I mean, this is not a qualitative comparison, Jay, before I make
I'm not saying a word.
But
that's really interesting that he's taken out the references to himself.
Reminds me a bit of Scorsese's work on Wolf of Wall Street in terms of energy. It feels very much like a director proving he can keep pace with younger directors. And got a lot of those, like, it's long takes up to 11. It's Spielberg on cocaine. It's you know, long takes that are rendered even longer through the use of CGI, whirling through, like, sets that don't physically exist, could never physically exist. There's a scene in the middle that I'm sure will aggravate both Jay and Ronan, and probably Emma as well.
Probably won't.
But which I quite enjoyed, because it's the closest that Spielberg comes to doing what Edelstein talks about, which is basically raising the middle finger and drawing attention to how empty and vapid this whole culture is. Unfortunately, he never quite follows through on it. Which brings us to number one, Peter Rabbit. Perfect Easter movie.
You know, I've got nothing.
I've got absolutely nothing on this.
Is this what's his face?
James Corden.
Yeah, that's why I've got
nothing.
And the entire Beatrix Potter estate apparently not particularly happy with it. Ooh. Her biographer is saying that she never would have endorsed such a film like this.
She hates James Corden.
Angry letters to the Irish Times complaining about what's been done. Do people care about Peter Rabbit that much?
Nope.
Like, I
that I know of. Didn't really have any cultural significance when I was growing up. I
kind of think of like Watership Down, but
me too.
Is it separate? It's a totally different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, they are. They both involve rabbits, though.
Oh no, but yeah, Peter Rabbit has.
I was more of the nightmare fuel of Watership Down when I was younger.
Yeah,
there was
a point. It doesn't mean anything to me, Peter Rabbit.
I think it was a point about 5 years ago where I discovered that Watership Down wasn't like it sounded, a Steven Seagal submarine movie.
That would be amazing.
Terrified me as a child. Terrified.
I would watch a cartoon in which Steven Seagal plays a bunny who has to save a submarine. Probably vintage Seagal, not so much modern Seagal.
No,
although you could get some great deep state puns in there. Anyway, let's move on to the new releases.
Hit me with them.
A Quiet Place.
This looks good. It's been previewing
pretty
much all my timeline seems to have seen it. So I went looking to see when it was on. I was like, it's nowhere showing it. Where are people seeing it? It's like, it's not out yet. So,
Remind me what this one is.
This one is
Krasinski horror.
John
Krasinski.
Oh, yes.
The high concept horror movie, where if they can hear you, they can hunt you.
Yeah, it's a nice concept, I think.
It is, and it's very well made as a horror film. It's very lean, it's very tight. It's 20 minutes of setup followed by 70 minutes of climax, which is what you're looking for in a horror film. It's very much of a style with what's also out this week, which is A Ghost Story, which is a sense of people who grew up watching the horror movies of like the 70s and 80s and saying, I like that, let's just whittle out all the stuff that I don't like, which is the boring character development that never goes anywhere, and let's turn into like a commentary on horror movie itself, because you get that with like, say, It Follows, or what's the other one I'm thinking of? Lights Out last year, where the literalization of watching a horror movie. Like, so in Lights Out, you have a monster that can only move if you don't look at it. In A Quiet Place, you have a monster that can move if you scream, which is your reaction to
The only thing I'd say about something like Lights Out, or indeed It Follows, is that whilst that kind of thing is very admirable, I don't think the films are particularly great.
Yeah. Great.
And I mean, that's all well and good, but I mean, if you're going to say we're doing this, but like,
it's relatively okay.
Relatively okay.
I thought It Follows was great.
Oh, it was okay.
All right, fine.
It was a good first half hour, and it kind of fell away after that.
It Follows totally loses me at the point where they turn around and the It thing is on a roof, and it's like there is no reason for it to be there other than cool shot, bro.
Really? That's your problem with It Follows?
That's one moment where it just abandons its own internal logic for the sake of like...
Its internal logic is that this is a monster that hunts people.
Which is scary.
And a monster that hunts people standing on roofs is also scary. The internal logic is preserved.
It's not.
It's like, why did it go to the trouble of climbing up there?
Because it looked cool in a shot.
Get a ladder out of shed.
Yeah. Did it go up the drain pipe? Did it go in the house and up the stairs?
I'm kind of
did
around
it ask permission on the way, you know.
And that tells you
the grip the film had on me, that I sat there going, how did it get into those? And did anybody go, excuse me, who are you?
Jay and Ronan sitting there wondering what the monster is like when it's getting coffee.
I could see a podcast in this one.
What does the It Follows monster get up to in
his
spare time?
I love the central idea that, you know, you can get on a plane and go really far away and eventually it'll plod towards you and get there. That's scary.
But will it get
it's
a plane?
It's not going to climb in a roof in the middle.
Will it get a plane?
Yeah.
Like, can it get a ticket?
Does it have ID?
Does it have ID? Can it get a flight?
How's its bluff game?
Because if you take a flight, surely there's no way it can get to you. Can it walk under the sea on the
floor?
It's like a monstery dead thing, so it's not going to drown.
Yeah.
But is it a physical thing? Like, will a shark eat it?
Yeah.
No, a shark can't eat it because a shark can't see it. See, this is...
It Follows too. Shark attack.
But this is why It Follows is so good. It's because...
It's
like,
not why it's so
until it gets on roofs.
Hold on. It's because It Follows is as much a logical statement as a statement of the monster's thing. Uh-huh. In that, like, you have a scene in the middle of the film where the characters logically deduce how the monster works in terms of luring it into a swimming pool, covering it with a towel so they can see it, and
idiotic,
it. No, but this is exactly what you guys are doing now, where you're like, can get on a plane. Ooh, can
we
throw a towel over?
Kind of.
I know, but it's an entire movie based around it, though.
I love the concept of it. I'm not sold on the execution, but I've been meaning to rewatch it for a long time because it is.
I haven't, and I won't.
Sorry, this got very heated.
I want to discuss that flight idea after the shark idea after the podcast.
Also out this week is 120 beats per minute.
Ronan.
Yes, this is great. I saw it back at the French Film Festival, the IFI, a couple of months back. It's the story of Act of Paris, sort of HIV rights organization who campaigned to have more cooperation from big pharma companies, big pharma rather, that's different, to just get the support they needed to get testing and get government support in terms of fighting HIV. It's really, really great. I really enjoyed it. I was a little worried. It's from the writer of The Class, which won the Palme d'Or a couple of years back, which I have to say I like, but I always felt was a little bit assured of its own importance. It has this kind of sense of, oh, I'm talking about these big themes, look at what I'm doing. And I think it talks about those well, but it feels overly confident to me.
I remember loving it at the time, but I can't point out anything. It's so long ago.
Yeah.
I'm
sure
it
was 2008.
I remember loving it. I didn't realize it was the same director. Yeah.
I had a worry going in
again.
That we'd have the same kind of situation here, because obviously it's the kind of story that lends itself to a sense of importance. It's not at all. It's very compassionate, funny, upsetting a lot of the time, beautifully acted. It kind of hinges around a love story, but it's got a great, big, sprawling cast, all of whom are incredible. I was really, really impressed by it, and it's very much film of the year so far for me.
Wow. Nice. That's two recommendations in the space of a single podcast. Sorry, Jeff?
No, I'm hoping to see it.
Okay, cool.
This week.
Also, out is Blockers, which we talked about earlier, so we'll move on to talking about Death Wish.
No, we won't. Do we have to?
Remember when this was going to be the surprise film at the Dublin Film Festival and everybody was terrified?
Yeah, I was.
That didn't make the highlight reel when they asked me what I thought it was, and I was like, I'm terrified it's going to be Death Wish. Surprisingly, that didn't make the video, promotional video afterwards.
Eli Roth directs Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
In an ad for the NRA.
It's just so disappointing to see Bruce Willis do stuff like this, because I was thinking recently, I love him so much in Moonrise Kingdom. And it's like, why can't you do something interesting again?
He sort of did that little while in the 90s as well, where he balanced really weird stuff, which was occasionally awful, like Breakfast of Champions was awful, Vanity Fair was awful, but he would actually try and perform. And then he'd sort of slip back into doing the like the Die Hard sequels or the, you know, that sort of stuff. So yeah,
I'm assuming you'll see this, Darren, because you see everything. So you're going to see it for me.
Am I going to be the canary in the coal
mine? No, you're not, because no matter what you say, I'm still not seeing it.
Such a noble calling.
Yeah. It's good to know. It's good to know what role I play on this podcast.
That's all right, Darren. That's all right. Okay. You're a good guy.
Thank you. I do my best. Guy. Also, this week, as we mentioned, Ghost Stories, which is not as effective or as scary as A Quiet Place. It's a little bit clever. It's smart. It's the kind of horror movie that Jay will hate. It's an anthology. It's a nod to the old British anthology horror movies. It's got a final twist that is not great, but otherwise it's quite canny, well observed, and it's more meditation on why we like horror movies than an effective horror movie itself.
Really,
and it's Ben Affleck. Is that the one Ben Affleck's in?
No, that's one Martin Freeman. Casey Affleck. It's a Ghost Story. Sadly, Ghost Stories isn't a sequel in which Rooney Mara has taken a bunch of pies in order to save herself from an army of Casey Affleck.
I'm really glad it's not a sequel because a Ghost Story is dreadful.
Well, Ghost Stories is much better.
Oh, I hate it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my, did I hate it. Oh,
people love that.
I know, but people are idiots, Roman. Not you discerning audience members.
No.
The rest of the people. You are all smart, smart people.
With great taste in film
podcast.
Also out in cinemas, but also on Sky Demand this week, so there's a high chance I may actually watch this. No, the Hurricane Heist, directed by Rob Cohen, who directed the first Fast and Furious movie that everybody's forgotten about now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which was 50 years ago, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. They may have wheeled him out of storage.
I think it's pretty obvious what this is about, isn't it? It's a heist of a hurricane, I'm presuming.
No, it's about breaking a boxer out of prison.
I hope you're joking.
I am joking.
Good lord. That really upset me.
That Irish snooker player.
Alex Hurricane Heist.
There you go.
A very moving personal biopic.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, it is about a heist that takes place during a hurricane starring Toby Kebbler, Maggie Grace, and Ryan Quantin. It's releasing simultaneously on Sky Anytime, much like the Monster... What was that one? Monster Family?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, if that was a knockoff of Hotel Transylvania, this is, like, Twister meets
this,
Takers.
This is a one-star, isn't it? It's going to be a one-star.
Jay, I don't judge movies ahead of time.
I do. I'm pretty happy to judge them.
I'm pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
Because everything is out this week.
It's a pretty busy week.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think this is because they're trying to get everything in, like, between Ready Player One and Infinity War. I Kill Giants, which is adapted by Joe Kelly from his graphic novel, directed by Anders Water, starring Zoe Saldana and Emotion Poots. It's about a teenage girl who struggles to escape from her struggles by imagining a fantasy world in which she kills giants. It's like Where the Wild Things Are if it were a comic book written by the guy who wrote Deadpool.
God, I love Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh, it's such a fantastic film.
Oh, it's
great.
I'm glad this is literal as well, though.
Okay. Yeah.
I like the literal I Kill Giants. It's actually about killing giants. I like this literal new
literal
kind of
theme you've got going on there.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Okay, let's see if we can keep this going with the next one.
Hit me with it.
Love, Simon.
Which,
does somebody love Simon?
Pretty,
No. It's a comma.
Sold.
There's a comma.
Ah, damn it.
So it's love from Simon.
Ah, okay.
Which is pretty literal. I haven't seen actually, but I've heard relatively good things.
Love, Simon. I have seen this. Oh. It's been pitched as the first studio-backed gay teenage romance, which is big milestone. I had an interesting time with this one. I really liked it. There's a lot to relate to in it. If you're the core demographic. But it's got some strange issues of representation where, of course, the first studio act, gay romance, is going to be a middle-class white guy who is, primarily presented as a very mass character. It does some interesting things with that, I have to say. It's got some sort of peripheral characters who the film will regularly look at and sort of, in a strange way, suggests that these are more interesting stories happening over here. And with that, it's almost saying, this is our starting point. Maybe we can move over here and look at these people and talk about those, which is really interesting. And I think it's very limited in what it can do, and it knows that. And the way it plays with that is really fascinating. There will be a piece on Scanon over the weekend where I explore that in more detail. On the whole, I did like it. It's got a fantastic script. There are some moments that are just laugh out loud funny and really lost me in a good way. Great performances on the whole as well. interesting, worth checking out, definitely, I think. But it's got some strange things going on that you'd expect from you know, a studio-backed film.
I was going to say, like, I mean, it's much like we're talking about Blockers. Like, it's probably like, this is a film that will have a wider push.
Yeah.
Than,
progress comes slowly. But the...
Okay, cool. And finally, Michael Inside, the big Irish release of the week, which is, which myself and Jay have seen.
Yeah, we have. And I think, weirdly, we're probably, and it sounds kind of terrible, in the minority of not gushing.
Yeah, I mean, I like it a little more than you do.
Yeah, I did like it, but I was expecting to love it.
I think it's better than Grand.
Yeah, I think it's good, and it's. And I think people should see it, and it's immaculately performed.
It's very important, it's very earnest, it's got, like, it's very well researched. It was researched for Pathways, who studied, like, prisoners who were released back into the community and stuff like that. It's very urgent, it's very important.
It's a lot of things to say about incarceration, about kind of the cycle of violence in workplace
and the way in which certain people from communities are sort of trapped long before they're imprisoned. The issue is that, for me, it felt very engineered. It felt more like a civics lesson, or, and this is going to sound very condescending, like, an after-school special of the highest caliber, in that it's very much, it presents his lead character, Michael McRae, as almost like an angel.
Oh, he is. Yeah. He's the perfect, like...
He's like the control case.
And the problem that brings to a film, and particularly brings to the narrative, is if you have somebody that's absolutely untouched by anything, you have to narratively contrive to get him to...
Well, he's entirely reactive. He's got it's important that he's got no agency in the narrative,
no,
but he never
fine.
Tries. That's the issue. But it'll be one thing if he struggled and he failed. But
there's
he
a particular
never...
bit near the end, which I'm not going to give you specifics, but he comes out of prison and there's a kind of narrative thing that happens.
Yeah.
That was...
Feels engineered.
Yeah, but
it's
basically... It's supposed to be the kind of crescendo of this is the end of the cycle inevitably, and there's an inevitability about kind of people being pulled into it. But it feels contrived in the way that the
everything
character
is positioned.
Just so, and you can see... A lot of, like, all films do it, scripts do it, but it's how well you hide it in a film, and it doesn't quite do it as well as a very previous film I used to live here, which is great.
Yeah, now, to be fair, I would argue, like, even the final minutes, while that plot development is incredibly contrived, the final minutes with the montage and the music and the score work very well. They're great filmmaking.
It's a good film. Like Frankberry's a terrifically talented filmmaker, so I'd like to see it, but it didn't quite work as well as I'd hoped. And I think the 5-star kind of raves that we're seeing at the moment. And also, I'm always very nervous of people calling something masterpieces when it's just come out.
Well,
but anyway,
well,
that's actually...
There's a 5-year moratorium on that.
But and that's fine. Like,
I'm seeing it tomorrow, actually, with the Q&A, so...
It's good, Andy, for Barry's interesting.
Don't ruin it too much. No,
it's good. It's worth
it,
seeing. Yeah. And Barry's an interesting guy. Like, we did the Q&A earlier, and he's good. Like, he's a smart man. And his two previous ones are great. Like, he's a really phenomenal filmmaker. One of our kind of best kind of up-and-coming filmmakers. So, like, I wouldn't put anybody off seeing it. I'm always...
Manage expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
it's
the hype, usual.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, like, I would argue that the hype for this has been phenomenal. Like, the advertising for this... Like,
they're going big. They're going wide with it.
Like,
it's in the city world, and it's going to be released wide. Like.
It's on buses.
And that's great to see.
The screenings to make sure that everybody'd seen it. There were, like, I think 6 or 7 press screens. They screened it for... Myself and Jay saw it last November, I think, to give an example, which is great to see that level of confidence behind that release. It was in the Odeon screen on Scene on Monday, which is another mass platform where people can buy a ticket to a film if you don't know what it is and they show it to you, which is just incredible confidence and very deserved.
I'm not trying to be too down on it. I'm not... Like, it's good, but it's just not great. And... I think if you go in expecting great, you may be a little disappointed. No, you may not. You might really love it. But I was a little disappointed, that's all.
Cool. And then finally, because this is the week that
you
just keeps giving...
You said that was
giving,
finally, Darren.
I did. But then I scrolled further down. This list has pages. Thoroughbreds is out, which is the last film, I believe, starring Anton Yelchin, which is Anya Taylor-Joy and Olivia Cooke, which is about the two upper-class teenage girls in suburban Connecticut who rekindle an unlikely friendship years after growing apart. It's showed, I think, during the film festival this year. I missed it while I was there.
Yeah.
But quite curious to see that. And finally, Wonderstruck.
What? How many finalies is it?
Yeah. Oh, this is the Alexander Payne film.
Todd Haynes.
Todd Haynes. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's Downsizing.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Which is a masterpiece.
No,
I mixed those two up as well. Why
me too,
is that?
I don't know. the kind of play at a certain level that almost.
I thought you were going to suggest similarities.
Well, they seem to. They're budgeting that kind of
similar scale.
Yeah, that's absolutely. They're definitely not similar.
Wonderstruck is okay. It's.
No.
Uh huh.
Oh, that's like saying it's grand.
It is. It's grand. I saw the trailer during the week, and the trailer does a better idea of mashing up its two storylines than the film does, which tells you a lot, I think. It's got these two parallel... Well, they're not parallel. Two stories told in parallel about a deaf girl in New York, kind of around 1920s, and then a kid in the modern day whose mother has died and he sort of runs away from his family. They come together as they inevitably must, but they're cut between and it's not done well. They're very different styles and it just completely punctures the pacing of the film repeatedly. They come together really well at the end, but until you get there, it's, you know, you're heaving to and fro and it's just very unbalanced, I thought.
And finally...
Darren, I'm going to kill you.
No, that was it, actually. but anyway, if people are listening to this podcast and would like a bit more of Jay, Ronan, or Emma in their lives, where can they find you guys online?
Oh, God. I'm on Twitter moaning about stuff at Jay Kyle.
Likewise, always giving out at Darren Ronan.
And I'm at Film, FILLUM, Facebook and Twitter.
Perfect. And also check out the new music as well, as mentioned earlier in the podcast. You can find me online, Darren Ascormany. I also co-host another podcast, The 250, and you can find that online on Twitter or by Googling. Take it easy, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
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 I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on. Huh?